This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. This is the history of Singapore. Episode 15, The Two Singapores. The Malayan Union was replaced by the Federation of Malaya on the 1st of February 1948. The intentions of the two territories could not have been made clearer in their names. The Malayan Union in Bahasa was called the Malayan Union. It had no Malay name. But the Federation of Malaya, in English, that's a neutral descriptive term that combines a political structure, a federation, with a geographical term, Malaya. The Federation of Malaya. In Malay, it was Persekutuan Tanah Melayu, the Federation of the Land of the Malays. And of course, to ensure that the Federation remained the land of the Malays, Singapore was excluded. Its left-wing Malays who sought Melayu Raya were excluded, and its majority Chinese population were excluded. In the Federation, as we discussed last week, the basic principles of the Federation Agreement were that Malaya was a Malay state, subject to the authority of the Malay rulers, and it stressed the individuality of the states. Citizenship was not a nationality, and citizens did not possess equal rights. Political power was concentrated in Malay hands, and power emanated from the rulers, and amendments to the constitution required their approval. Singapore, on the other hand, received its own constitution the next month, March 1948, which was more liberal, more progressive than the Federation's. For one, it included 6 elected members in the 22-seat Legislative Council. The Federation's Council had no elected members, and they would not have elections until 1955, although local elections would be held from December 1951, starting with Penang, but even then, that's over 3 years after Singapore. Under Singapore's new constitution, the government had a similar structure to today. Instead of a president, we had the queen. Instead of prime minister, we had the governor. Instead of a cabinet, we had an executive council. And instead of a parliament, we had a legislative council. But it's basically the same system as today, but with different names. And of course, with the important exception that the governor was all-powerful and responsible only to the British cabinet in London, specifically to his boss, the British Secretary of State for the Colonies. Otherwise, you can think of it in a similar way that the governor runs the government, the executive council will advise him and propose legislation, and then it would be debated and passed by the legislative council. Now, the legislative council had 22 members. 9 were colonial officials, such as the colonial secretary, the attorney general, or the financial secretary. It also had 13 members who were not colonial officials, and they were called the non-official or unofficial members for short. These included 4 members nominated by the governor, and 6 elected members, and 3 members nominated by the Chambers of Commerce. One by the Singapore Chambers of Commerce, which was mainly European, Eurasian, one by the Chinese Chambers of Commerce, and one by the Indian Chambers of Commerce. This special dispensation for commercial interests was fiercely attacked by some. Tan Chin Tuan, for example, declared it as, quote, repugnant to all ideas of democracy, unquote, because it effectively gave rich merchants extra votes in the Legislative Council. Why should some people get 2 votes? A democratic parliament does not have nominated members, only elected ones, and so everyone gets 1 vote. That's how democracy works. And that's why, just under a decade later, when we negotiated a new constitution for a self-governing Singapore, one of the important points was to create a parliament that was 100% elected members only. Because having nominated members is repugnant to all ideas of democracy, and a parliament with nominated members is not a democratic one, but a tool of colonialism. This was true in 1948, and it's true today. But of course, in 1948, we were still a colony, and so the council was still a tool of colonialism. And the government did not fully trust the people and wanted to ensure that they stacked the deck in their favour. They did not think we were loyal enough or smart enough or capable enough to run our own country, and so we needed the British to gradually guide us to independence. But the important thing is that inherent in this constitution was that power emanated from the people, that Singapore belonged to its people, and that the British were holding power for us temporarily and would eventually return power to us, to we the people of Singapore. And that key belief is the big difference between Singapore's constitution and the Federation's constitution. And the roots of this, of course, as I mentioned way back in episode 2, is Raffles and his vision of personal liberty. So, who are we the people of Singapore? Well, the 1947 census enables to list some basic statistics. Singapore was 78% Chinese, 12% Malay and Indonesian, 7% Indian, and 3% Eurasian, European and other ethnic groups. The population was far more settled, more gender balanced, and far more locally oriented than any since the first census by John Crawford in 1824. Among the Chinese, for example, 60% were born in Malaya. Well, more than half of those born in China had never been back or even sent any money there. So their connection with the ancestral land was very tenuous. So you could say that 80% of Chinese had no personal connection to China. The Indians, on the other hand, had stronger links to their homeland, which was closer and until 1947 remained part of the empire. But after 1947, the number of Indians rapidly increased. Many came south from the Federation to flee the violence of the Malayan emergency. Others, particularly the Sikhs and the Sindhis, came to Singapore fleeing the violence of India's partition. In addition, many Malayalees came from Kerala in the immediate post-war years. From this period, increasing numbers of Indians settled permanently in Singapore, and they brought with them a greater political awareness, a greater political sophistication born from their experience in India, from trade union politics, from national politics, and born from their pride at India's independence in 1947. And of course, as a minority community, they were worried about their place in Singapore. And so, when registration to vote opened in 1948, they rushed to register. Out of 23,000 registered voters, 10,000 were Indian. And 8 of the 15 candidates, more than half who stood for election, were Indian. The big winner of the first election in 1948 was the Singapore Progressive Party, founded by C.C. Tan, John Laycock, and Nazir Ahmad Mala. It was a conservative party with all its leaders coming from the pro-British commercial and professional class, and their platform was cooperation with the British for gradual independence. Don't rock the boat. They were the only party to fight the 1948 election and won 3 of the 6 seats, with the other 3 won by independents. Indeed, the first elections were won by some of the most famous names in Singapore's merchant history: C.C. Tan, Nazir Malal, Muhammad Javad Namazi, John Laycock, and Saron Jubir, who would later go on to have a successful political career in Malaysia and serve as an UMNO minister in the Malaysia cabinet. All 6 successful candidates were lawyers. But the important thing is no successful candidate ran on racial or communal lines, and the election was refreshingly free of racial friction. The governor, Sir Franklin Gimson, commented with satisfaction that, quote, "Communalism, as known in other countries, has never carried any weight in Singapore, and I am confident that it never will, as no truly democratic system can ever be founded otherwise." Unquote. And by 1950, Singapore's economy had recovered. It had surpassed its pre-war peak. It was once again the richest city-state in all of Asia, the shining jewel of Southeast Asia. So, it all sounds great. We're doing well on the surface. Because all these facts also conceal some deeper truths. That Singapore's electoral system, and indeed Singapore itself, was deeply divided, particularly by language and class. Gimson's comments reveal the blind spots of government. That from their privileged positions in Government House and Town Hall and their offices around the Padang, there were many truths about Singapore, and especially about its racism, elitism, and discrimination that the privileged elite simply could not see. What were they? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of the History of Singapore, The Two Singapores. The 1948 election, the vote was given to all British subjects who had resided in Singapore at least 1 year prior to the election, which was a very liberal requirement. However, out of a population of 940,000, only around 200,000 qualified. And out of this potential electorate of 200,000, only 23,000 registered, of which, as I mentioned before, 10,000 were Indian. So why was the number who qualified so low, and the number who registered even lower? Well, let's take a look at what Singapore was like in 1948 for the rest of us, those who weren't part of the wealthy English-speaking merchant and professional class. I mentioned in the last episode that the British returned to Malaya in 1945, needing to make it immediately profitable to pay for the rebuilding of Britain and to service Britain's massive war debt to America. I also mentioned in an earlier episode how British colonial policy had focused on cultivating a rich merchant and professional class as collaborators, while exploiting the vast majority of the people, the working class. The British and their collaborators suppressed the wages of the working class and prevented the rise of an independent trade union movement to keep costs down and profitability up. They would make concessions only when necessary to stem the rise of worker protest. As a result, Singapore was highly unequal, very highly discriminatory. There was a sharp divide between those who worked in the professions connected with global capital, the people who worked in finance and technology and its supporting professions like law and accounting, and those who worked in the traditional blue-collar jobs, your dock workers and labourers and chauffeurs and houseboys and rickshaw drivers. And so, of course, the moment the British got back, they immediately brought back their exploitative system in order to quickly maximise Malaya's dollar-earning capacity. The British military administration used the same methods the Japanese used to recruit and discipline workers. They paid workers at set pre-war rates that were nowhere enough to live on. But perhaps the worst thing they did was to issue opium as an alternative payment in order to hook workers on opium, thus creating an alternative incentive to work, an immoral, disgusting incentive to work. They denied even modest improvements in wages and conditions to the workers. And so people asked, how are these British different from the Japanese? Why did we celebrate the return of these white people if they were going to do to us what the Japanese did to us? The government, including the military, was by far the largest employer in Singapore, employing nearly 40% of the workforce in 1946, a proportion that remained roughly consistent over the next two decades. It was therefore in a position, legislatively and physically, to establish island-wide employment practices and criteria. And they refused to employ the Chinese educated. By refusing to employ the Chinese educated, it condemned them to the traditional half of Singapore's economy, the exploited half. The English educated had a monopoly of government and well-paying white-collar jobs. There was no way around this. Even if you wanted to go to a technical training school, to one of the precursors to our modern-day ITEs, you needed an English education. Why? And this was despite a growing shortage of skilled labour. So in response, to protect themselves, workers, very logically, joined trade unions in droves. And in this brief period between 1946 and 1948, when the MCP was legal and trade unions and trade unionism was tolerated by the government, this was massively successful. The MCP and its trade union affiliates embarked on a massive series of strikes and demonstrations from late 1945 onwards. Between the 1st of April 1946 and the 31st of March 1947, over 1.3 million working days were lost to strikes in Singapore. The government sector was particularly targeted due to its pernicious and discriminatory policies. The Singapore Federation of Trade Unions was able to bring Singapore's transport system to a halt, nearly paralysing the island's economy. Through this sustained period of labour activism, the MCP was able to significantly improve the economic position of a large section of the labour force, proving the effectiveness of industrial action. At this time, the MCP's actions were based on a policy of constitutional struggle. They took advantage of the post-war atmosphere of political liberty and assumed that the British would tolerate open political, trade union and other activities that were legal and that would be considered unremarkable in Britain itself. But of course, a showdown was coming. The British wanted the economy to produce to its fullest, to its soul and body crushing maximum. The trade unions, with their demands for human rights and reasonable wages that people can live on, were getting in their way. But more broadly, the MCP was an anti-colonial party. It sought social revolution and a Malayan Republic. The British wanted to preserve the old order, protect their colonial interests, and protect the conservative Malay monarchy. Economically, politically, socially, the parties were implacably opposed. March 1947 is the turning point. The MCP leader, Lloyd Dek, was exposed as a British double agent and he fled with the entirety of the party coffers. The MCP was broke and desperate. Lloyd Dek's treachery before and after the war and during the war had killed off all the experienced and talented leaders in the MCP, leaving the party in the hands of young, inexperienced leaders like Chin Ping, a mere 23 years old, a man who was humiliated and angry at Lloyd Dek's betrayal, furious at the injustice and discrimination of the British economic system. He was just itching to lash out. And at the same time, circumstances turned against the MCP. The economy improved and so did workers' livelihoods, so they were more content and less likely to strike. The MCP leadership increasingly used labour militancy as a tool in the political struggle against the Federation Agreement. This disillusioned the workers, who felt like they were being exploited for political purposes now. So their participation in strikes petered out. At the same time, the British responded with measures that even their most ardent supporters agreed were, quote, aggressively restrictive. They applied the pre-war ordinances requiring unions to register and operate under highly restrictive circumstances. They denied the MCP all avenues of legitimate political and trade union expression. Police repression of trade union activities was relentless, even killing workers in several incidents. The Singapore Federation of Trade Unions was outright banned on 31st May 1948. And by this time, most MCP leaders had moved north of the causeway. The MCP had lost its grip on the labour movement in Singapore and they realised that urban revolution in Singapore had no chance of success. Singapore was too small, too urban, too tightly controlled, too capitalist. The Federation was a much more fertile field to plough. And within the MCP, questions were increasingly being asked about the viability of constitutional struggle. For 3 years, the MCP had organized the labour movement and had some spectacular successes, including the October 1947 general strike. But the British government simply refused to negotiate and applied repressive measures. There's little point to a democratic process when only one side is participating. And in all likelihood, the young hotheads of the MCP saw the British as no different to the Japanese. The British were foreign, imperialist occupiers who were exploiting, torturing, and murdering Chinese workers, just like the Japanese. And just 6 years ago, the Japanese had demonstrated that a small but determined force with good leadership could sweep the British away. But that same force never managed to defeat the MCP. Surely now the MCP had a chance. They had fought on behalf of the people, on behalf of the workers. Surely the people would support them against the imperialist occupiers. And so in March 1948, an MC Central Committee meeting in Singapore agreed to prepare for eventual armed struggle. Labour militancy increased and attacks on the states increased. Now the British did not actually have evidence at this point in time that the MCP were behind the increasing violence. But European businessmen and Malay politicians pressured the British to take action and the colonial authorities needed a scapegoat. Bowing to pressure, they made a leap of faith and declared the MCP to be responsible. Having already failed to protect the colonial system once, the government could not fail a second time. The authorities badly needed to restore faith in the colonial regime and produce results, and the MCP was the enemy they needed. A state of emergency was declared in the Federation on June 1948. Now, in Singapore, the trend actually had been towards greater labour peace, but the MCP, from the British perspective, the MCP could not be permitted to use it as a base, and so the emergency regulations were extended to Singapore 1 week later. Troops were dispatched through the streets, and the emergency regulations empowered the government to detain without trial, to ban publications, to take possession of any building or vehicle, to control all road movements, disperse any meeting, impose curfews, arrest anybody without a warrant, impose the death penalty for possession of arms, punish anyone suspected of disseminating false information, confiscate businesses suspected of aiding the MCP, detain anyone suspected of aiding or consorting with the MCP, use all force necessary to arrest persons, evict persons occupying state land. These measures were draconian, suspending all the normal rules of government, all the normal rights of the people. They gave the government unprecedented power over the people. And so they were meant to be strictly temporary, purely for the state of emergency. Unfortunately, many of these laws are still with us today. Power, once seized by a government, is very hard for the government to relinquish. The emergency regulations were meant to be temporary measures to combat a temporary enemy. And this enemy has long been defeated. This enemy never had much of a foothold in Singapore to begin with. Yet, these regulations still exist, brought back under different names. Most famously, the power to detain without trial was converted in 1955 to the Preservation of Public Security Ordinance, then after merger into the Internal Security Act. But the government must have a state of emergency in order to justify the continuing existence of laws to deal with emergency, and more importantly, to justify the lack of oversight over the government on the use of these regulations. Hence, the government's continuing narrative that Singapore is constantly on the verge of disaster by external forces, communists, Marxists, and now Islamic terrorists. All this is to create a state of fear, a state of emergency that allows the government to suspend normal practice, to deprive us of our human rights, to torture us, lock us up, deport us. All of this stemmed originally from the British fear of losing Malaya a second time, to an enemy that they didn't even have proof were responsible. But they were the perfect excuse for what the British wanted to do, what they needed to do, and what, let's not forget, they were doing elsewhere in the world as well. So the MCP was banned, and so were many nationalist parties and organizations like the Malayan Democratic Union, which dissolved itself. Newspapers were closed and editors imprisoned. Thousands of political activists and trade unionists were deported or imprisoned. Those not born in Malaya were banished back to the land of their birth. Throughout Malaya, over 30,000 people were detained between 48 and 52. It was later estimated that in Singapore alone, 90,000 people underwent the detention screening process and 20,000 were voluntarily or forcibly deported over the course of the emergency. Intense political repression suspended all forms of anti-colonial or progressive politics in Singapore, legitimate or otherwise. In the Federation, MCP members fled to the jungles to wage a guerrilla war against the colonial regime. However, the MCP never managed a significant presence in Singapore. Looking back in 1955, a special branch report noted that, quote, "the numerically small nature of the MCP in Singapore at the beginning of the emergency was wholly inadequate for the tasks with which it was faced," unquote. Singapore's size and urbanization made it easy to control, and it became a police state with compulsory registration and police checks. Over 1,000 people were searched every day at roadblocks with, quote, "not a single hour going by," unquote, without someone being searched for weapons or having their papers checked. The MCP's Singapore Town Committee floundered through the emergency, constantly hounded and lacking manpower and material resources. They were unable to carry out their plans and had little control over their followers who embarked on random violence. Factories and businesses, both European and locally owned, were targeted indiscriminately. This alienated the Chinese community from the MCP, which is not to say that the Chinese community then embraced the British, of course, because the entire community was treated as a potential fifth column with suspicion and hate. The Chinese also listened as Radio Malaya reported on the forced resettlement of Chinese in the Federation into concentration camps, read about the abuses meted out to their relations up north, and welcomed refugees from Johor and elsewhere who fled across the causeway to Singapore to escape the brutality. By 1952, the government declared the emergency had undergone a complete change in its character, as the MCP declared a cessation of hostilities in Singapore. Attacks tailed off to less than a tenth, and the distribution of MCP propaganda was negligible. The MCP's courier networks to Johor were smashed, its supply lines cut off, its personnel reduced to a die-hard handful, unable to communicate with each other. Most arrested cadres, including Kuo Ren-hui, one of the two leaders of the Singapore Town Committee, joined the special branch and helped capture their former comrades. Most arrested MCP leaders turned and worked for special branch, and their successors were in turn duly arrested within several months. Meanwhile, left-wing trade unions were all disbanded or became defunct. No one was now representing the workers. This vacuum was seen by the British as a, quote, glorious opportunity, unquote, to organize a moderate democratic trade union movement free from political influence. Somehow they had forgotten to check their own history of labor in Britain. Accordingly, in May 1951, the Singapore Trades Union Congress was born out of 24 unions. And as in other areas, the British encouraged the development of a compliant English-speaking class of local elites to lead the unions. And so the STUC was led by V.K. Nair and Lim Yew Hock, who became closely associated with the government and business interests. Non-English-speaking workers perceived the STUC as colonial stooges. Its officials were predominantly white-collar workers, Indian, English-speaking, and more interested in using the unions as stepping stones to winning legislative and city council elections. It was riven by internal rivalry, with the moderate Chinese Lim Yew Hock and Fabian socialist Eurasian Francis Thomas fighting with the radical Indian Peter Williams and conservative Dasaratha Raj warring with all of them. More broadly, government unions were kept separate from private sector unions to ensure no involvement in politics. Unions were kept under control by a mixture of threats and inducements. The government and employers cooperated to render unions ineffective. With the full force of the law behind them, employers could easily break strikes by hiring new workers and imposing lockouts at will. Intimidating union officials, calling in the police and transferring disputes to the Labour Department, which would inevitably rule in favour of employers. Workers were pressured not to join unions, and where this failed, the employers just established rival unions. Employers freely rewrote contracts to cut wages and fired workers who protested. Under these circumstances, just 13 strikes occurred between 1949 and 1952, and not a single one extracted any meaningful concessions. So, this vacuum of worker representation was thus not filled by the pro-British unions. Instead, the vacuum was partially filled by the secret societies. It is ironic that the emergency actually increased the amount of lawlessness in Singapore because it increased the power of the criminal gangs. On the one hand, you have ineffective pro-government unions and political parties. On the other hand, the genuine trade unions and political parties have been crushed and suppressed. So the secret societies seized this opportunity for profit and power. They were a lot of things, but they were definitely not communist. And so they also had a common enemy with Special Branch, which was happy to go easy on the secret societies while it concentrated its resources on battling communism. The secret societies charged protection fees to the workers and in exchange blackmailed and threatened bosses and then took the money as their own. This was not real worker protection. The secret societies were criminal gangs run for profit who divided up Singapore into spheres of territory and terrorized workers and employers alike. Of course, there were still some secret societies who clung on to the old pre-war notions of honour and justice, but they were a small minority. So, to return to our question, out of a population of 940,000, only 200,000 qualified and 23,000 registered. Why? Well, again, discrimination. The vote was open to British subjects resident in Singapore for at least a year, but most Chinese-speaking Singaporeans, even after living in Malaya for nearly their whole lives, were not granted residency. And even if they were, they needed to write out forms in English to register. And even if they did qualify, they needed paperwork to prove their status. Licenses, registrations, permanent addresses. Most Chinese people simply didn't have these things and didn't know how to get them or maybe lost them or destroyed them during the war to stay safe. So this encapsulated the severe discrimination the Chinese-speaking faced. Simply by virtue of being Chinese and speaking Chinese, they were excluded by the official system which refused to accommodate their needs. So there were two Singapores. There's the peaceful, constitutional one for the English-speaking, free of racial and communal friction, as Gibson boasted, who could elect representatives to the Legislative Council and get a second vote through nominated councillors, and now lived in the richest city in Asia. This is the Singapore you see recorded in the official document. But there was a second repressive, discriminatory Singapore for those who did not speak and write English, which at this time was over 90% of the population, who lacked parties and trade unions that represented their interests. And the worst off, of course, were the Chinese-speaking, who were regarded with suspicion and treated with fear and hostility by their own government because they shared a common language with the MCP. So the helpless Chinese-speaking quietly fumed in anger. And by 1953, the Chinese language press was describing the situation as a lit powder keg. They predicted that if nothing was done, it was only a matter of time before workers' anger exploded. They urged the government to allow stronger unions and fair arbitration mechanisms and talk to people who could genuinely represent the workers and their interests. But the government ignored them. And when the emergency finally came to an end in Singapore, when politics opened up again that year, the strength of Chinese anger at colonial abuse and neglect and discrimination would blow up in the government's faces. And the Chinese would start by doing this in perhaps the most Chinese way possible. Because the first great mass movement in Malaya, the first truly pan-Malayan mass movement, would arise in 1953 to create the great symbol of Chinese loyalty to Malaya, the great symbol of defiance towards the colonial authorities, the institution that was the epitome of Malayan Chinese society built in the heart of Singapore. And that was Nanyang University. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the show, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. See you next week when we talk about Nanyang University. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.